This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Herman Melville, or rather Ishmael, once warned that, "For as this appalling ocean surrounds the verdant land, so in the soul of man there lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all the horrors of the half-known life. God keep thee. Push not off from that isle, thou canst never return." He was describing a profound experience of loss, moving from one culture to another and from innocence to experience. Once left behind, home can never be experienced as it once was before, as, to use a phrase of Clifford Geertz, the liberating experience of confrontation with radical otherness. And the place to which one has traveled can never be like the home or the experience of home from which one originated. Jamaica Kincaid was born on the small island of Antigua and educated in the British colonial system. She left in 1966 at age 17 and came to the United States to work as an au pair. She never seemed to regard her past as one of peace and joy, even though it was filled with strangeness and wonder. Out of her vertiginous experience of casting off, she has written trenchantly of the horrors, past and present, of colonialism and their impact on the psyche. In her novels and essays, Jamaica Kincaid has depicted with haunting power the psychological experience of self-expulsion and self-definition. In her books and essays on gardening, she has explored further our relation to the natural world, as well as the possibilities and significant limitations of power and control. The autobiographical in Jamaica Kincaid's work is nothing less than the creation and maintenance, the invention of the fiercely independent mind and soul. And in this, she is really akin of Proust, who is celebrating the 100th anniversary of his great novel. In her novels, Annie, John, Lucy, The Autobiography of My Mother, and most recently, See Now Then, we see, and most of all hear, the question, who am I, in relation to the pull both of the past and the present. The past as it is continually revised in present consciousness, in relation to national identities, and most profoundly, in relation to parents and family. Her writing transcends anything that could be called colonial or post-colonial literature because it explores the possibilities of love beyond self-love, the half-known life and lives, as well as the abyss that lies just beyond our grasp of our self-regard. Observing any human being from infancy, seeing someone come into existence like a new flower in bud, each petal first tightly furled around another, and then the natural loosening and unfurling, the opening into a bloom, the life of that bloom must be something wonderful to behold, Zoëlla Claudette Richardson writes in The Autobiography of My Mother. And she continues, "All this is something so wonderful to observe, so wonderful to behold. The pleasure for the observer, for the beholder, is an invisible current between the two, observer, observed and observer, beheld and beholder. And I believe that no life is complete, no life is really whole without this invisible current, which is in many ways a definition of love." We follow this narrator as she develops this invisible current, loving herself in defiance, but also out of despair. In Jamaica Kincaid's fiction, we are in the presence of a mind and a voice seeking this invisible current of love, which is found most forcefully in the lyrical current of her, and rhythms of her prose, a lyricism and nimble psychological dance unmatched by any prose writer in working in English today. Please join me in welcoming Jamaica Kincaid.
So much,
Robert Fagan, or Bob as I know him.
And thank you. And thank you for such a generous introduction. I unfortunately can't see you. And I would feel more confident if I could see you. But never mind, I often do a lot of things that I can't see, but I do it. You know. Thank you very much for coming. But I think you do this all the time, that this is such a wonderful event, a weekly event, that I think if just the empty stage showed up, you'd come, and you'd be... and it would be quite worthwhile. There's a clock. I'm going to read to you from a book. It's no longer new, but it's the last novel, the novel I've just published in February of this year, and it's called See Now Then, and it is the opposite of Chekhov. It has no cherries in it, and there is not an orchard, though I would have liked to have put an orchard in it. It is, I can tell you all the things it's not. It's not about a black woman, though you might think she's black, but, and she could very well be, but I didn't, she is black, but only in an aesthetic sense, she's black because it's such a beautiful color. Why wouldn't you want to be that? So it's not about a black woman, and she is not particularly, she suffers, I can tell you that, but she doesn't have the certain way of look. She has all the burdens of someone you would say is a black woman, but she doesn't see them in the way you might like them to be seen or are used to them being seen. She hopes to be part of the general human condition, not separate from it. So that is what the book is not. The book is then, what I was trying to write was about the way in which time operates within human consciousness. And I wrote the book about a family who lives in New England. They do live in New England, and they live in a house. The house is called the Shirley Jackson House, and I called it that. I could have called it the Robert Frost House, but I didn't, because Robert Frost has a house near this village. But in that house, his son killed himself, and I didn't want that particular kind of reference to be on this family. They are not suicidal, this family. They live in the Shirley Jackson House. The Shirley Jackson House, I only called the house that because I loved the way the words Shirley Jackson felt in house. So that's the sort of thing that would inform my writing. So the Shirley Jackson House in which this family lives, and they are falling apart. I suppose they are divorcing, though the word divorce isn't quite made much of. And they're only fracturing in the way the larger world, the earth, fractures and comes together. And so there's a lot of reference to our common human home, the earth, and its makings and its eruptions and its sweet states. Their name is Mr. Sweet and Mrs. Sweet. They are only known as Mr. and Mrs. Sweet, incidentally. And the children's names, the boy's name, Heracles, not Hercules. And the girl is named Persephone. And she's always the beautiful, and he's always the young. So it's the young Heracles, the beautiful Persephone, Mr. and Mrs. Sweet, living in the Shirley Jackson House in the range of mountains, which are the oldest range of mountains on this continent, the Appalachians. They are part of the Appalachian Trail. That's their home. So that's it. The vague outline. You can see it's not Chekhov. It begins in this way. I shall read to you things through it, throughout it. But the sentences are long, I should tell you, so you should get used to that. But I have always written long sentences, which, because I love long sentences. The sentences are long. What else? But I think they're quite beautiful, the long sentences. So here it is. See now then the dear Mrs. Sweet, who lived with her husband, Mr. Sweet, and their two children, the beautiful Persephone and the young Heracles, in the Shirley Jackson house, which was in a small village in New England. The house, the Shirley Jackson house, sat on a knoll, and from a window Mrs. Sweet could look down on the roaring waters of the Parron River as it fell furiously and swiftly out of the lake, a man-made lake also named Parron, and looking up she could see surrounding her the mountains named Bald and Hale and Anthony, all part of the Green Mountain Range, and she could see the firehouse, where sometimes she could attend a civic gathering and hear her government representative say something that might seriously affect her and the well-being of her family, or see the firemen take out the fire trucks and dismantle various parts of them and put the parts back together, and then polish all the trucks, and then drive them around the village with a lot of commotion before putting them away again in the firehouse. And they reminded Mrs. Sweet of the young Heracles, for he often did such things with his toy fire trucks. But just now, when Mrs. Sweet was looking out from a window in the Shirley Jackson house, her son no longer did that. From that window again, she could see the house where the man who invented time-lapse photography lived, but he was dead now, and she could see the house, the yellow house, that Homer had restored so carefully and lovingly, polishing the floors, painting the walls, replacing the pipes, all this in the summer before that awful fall when he went hunting and, after shooting with his bow and arrow the largest deer he had ever shot, he dropped down dead while trying to load it onto the back of his truck. And Mrs. Sweet did see him lying in his coffin in the Maha funeral home, and she thought then, why does a funeral home always seem so welcoming, so inviting from the outside? So comfortable are the chairs inside, the beautiful golden glow of the lamplight softly embracing every object in the room, the main object being the dead. Why is this so? Mrs. Sweet said to herself as she saw Homer lying all alone and snug in his coffin, and he was all dressed up in brand new hunting clothes, a red and black plaid jacket made of boiled wool and a red knitted hat, all clothing made by Woolrich or Johnson Brothers or some outdoor clothing outfitters like that. And Mrs. Sweet wanted to speak to him, for he looked so much like himself, to ask him if he would come to paint her house, the Shirley Jackson house, or could he come and do something, anything, fix the pipes, clean the gutters of the roof, check to see if water had leaked into the basement, because he appeared to be so like himself. But his wife said to her, Homer shot the biggest deer of his life, and he died while trying to put it in the back of his truck. And Mrs. Sweet was sympathetic to the worldliness of the dead, for she could make herself see the army of worms, parasites, who had, without malice aforethought, begun to feed on Homer, and would soon reduce him to the realm of wonder and disillusion, so sad all of this that Mrs. Sweet could see then, while standing at the window of the house in which Shirley Jackson had lived, and across the way was the house in which old Mrs. McGovern had died, and she had lived in it for many years before she became old. She had lived in her house, built in a neoclassical something style that harkened back from another era, long ago, long before Mrs. McGovern had been born and then become a grown-up woman who married and lived with her husband in the Yellow House and made a garden of only peonies, big white ones that were streaked with a wine-dark red on the petals nearest the stamens, like an imagined night crossing an imagined day. So had been those peonies in Mrs. McGovern's garden, and she had grown other things, but no one could remember what they were. Only her peonies were committed to memory, and when Mrs. McGovern had died, and so therefore vanished from the face of the earth, Mrs. Sweet had dug up those peonies from that garden, Festiva Maxima was their name, and planted them in her own garden, a place Mr. Sweet and the beautiful Persephone and even the young Heracles hated. The Pembrokes, father and son, mowed the lawn, though sometimes the father went off to Mount Pelier, the capital, to cast votes for or against, as he felt to be in the best interest of the people who lived in that village in New England, which even now is situated on the banks of the River Parron. And the other people in that village, the Wilmingtons, lived always in their house, and the Atlases too, and so were the Elwells, the Elkinsons, the Powers. The library was full of books, but no one went into it, only parents with their children, parents who wanted their children to read books, as if reading books were a mysterious form of love, a mystery that must remain so. The small village in New England had held all that and much, much more, and all that and much, much more was then and now, time and space intermingling, becoming one thing, all in the mind of Mrs. Sweet. Oh, this is terrible. I marked it so carefully, and now it's all... But it's coming. Oh dear, it is coming. I'm supposed to count to 10. I was told this when I was being given a way of how to teach. Okay, this is getting annoying. I just passed that place, but... Okay. I'm coming. Ah. Because I want to read to you about her children coming home from school and I did have it marked. This feels rather dreamlike, as if as if it's happening to somebody else. That I'd been asked to read by the Lannan Foundation. I dreamt this, and when I got on stage, I couldn't find the place I was supposed to read, and it happened over and over again. And then I woke up and I was so relieved that it wasn't true, that I was just asleep in my bed. I have found it. Chapter 7. That afternoon, at exactly 3:45, the beautiful Persephone and the young Heracles got off the school bus and found that their mother, the dear Mrs. Sweet, was not waiting to pick them up. They saw the school bus, driven by the madly named Mr. Strange, disappear around the corner below the Bennington Monument. They saw their companions, some wayward boys and girls who lived in villages that were surrounded by evergreens of every kind, except for broadleaf, and the evergreens were all sick with a blight of rust. And these companions were very bad, for sometimes the boys among them pummeled the young Heracles almost to death, and the discipline he required to restrain himself from gathering them up altogether in his large brown hands and making them as lifeless as his old socks was greater than the force he had used to smite the entire city of Thebes as it appeared in his handheld Nintendo game. Those boys, in any case, had names of no distinguished origin, their names being Tad, Ted, Tim, and such. But the bus stop was empty. Of Mrs. Sweet, and the young Heracles was beside himself with anxiety and sorrow, for he loved his mother so, and only so. And a dark cloud full of toxic fire emerged from his forehead, and he directed it toward the top of the Bennington Monument, a structure that was dedicated to a battle that led to a defeat and a triumph. And the defeated and the triumphant were now settled into the normal disfigurement of everyday living. And he caused it to fall to the ground, just missing a bus full of citizens from Germany who were taking a tour of New England just then. So beside himself was Heracles with anger and grief over Mrs. Sweet not being there to greet him when the school bus arrived at the bus stop, that he sank to the ground, drew his feet up into his chest, his chin resting on his knees, so that he looked like an illustration of a fully developed child intact in his mother's womb, an illustration commonly found on the walls of a doctor's office. "Oh, come on!" And that was the voice of the beautiful Persephone, his sister. And that is as it should be, for it was spring, and she was released from living in the depths of the pocket of Mr. Sweet's old Brooks Brothers tweed jacket. Not knowing what else to do, she lifted him up with much ease, as if he were some just harvested asparagus, or a pint of strawberries, or a plate of peas, or as if she were removing the hamster that had died overnight in its cage. And she placed him in the right-hand pocket of her own jacket, which was made from polyethylene terephthalate, and the pocket itself was lined with rayon. Now, she said as she stroked the curve of his back with her thumb, her forefingers shielding his head, which rested against his knees. It is very bad that she's not here to meet us once again when we get off the bus from school. Where the hell could she be? What the hell could she be doing? Oh, she just sits in that room writing about her goddamn mother, as if people had never had a mother who wanted to kill them before they were born in the history of the world. And the stupid father named Mr. Potter, who couldn't even read, and the fucking stupid little island on which she was born, full of stupid people whom history would be happy to forget. But she has to keep reminding everybody about that place and those people, and no one cares, and she can't stand it. And where is she? She's in that little room off the kitchen, and from that room she can see the kitchen, and she's making us whatever we all want to eat, and none of us want the same thing. And how she manages to keep writing that shit. Make her stop. Make her stop before I kill her. And it was so much better when she would only knit us stockings that were too big before they were washed, and then they were too small after they were washed. and they just gathered dust in the wash basket because she couldn't bear to throw them out. After all the time she had spent knitting them, and the hats never kept us warm. They fell into our eyes when we were skiing, and I almost killed myself coming down that black diamond, wearing the stupid hat she had stayed up making for me as a present. And it is the stupid writing, it is the stupid writing, it is the stupid writing that keeps her from being on time to meet the school bus that had driven, that was driven by Mr. Strange. Ralph is his name, too, and that is not a name with a distinguished lineage. And a man, you know, who should be locked up in a jail in a cell that is buried underground, could come and pick us up and take us to his house and murder us or violate us sexually, and we would never be seen again or heard of again, not even be mentioned on the nightly news, vanish from the face of the earth like a species from a geological era that isn't even yet detected. What is she doing? What is she doing? What the hell is she doing? She's sitting there in that room at the big desk that Donald made for her, and she's thinking of a sentence and the way to end it. My mother would kill me if she got the chance. I would kill my mother if I had the courage. And as if such a thing were possible, she lives in that world of the room with the desk and the kitchen just beyond, and she leaves us here all alone for a man to murder us, for tourists from Germany to stare at us, for all the other children and their mothers to see that she doesn't love us. She only loves the world that she carries around in her head, a torrent of lies all in her head. We are nothing to her, nothing, nothing, only those words in her head. And now look, the night is coming. The ink black night is going to swallow us up, and we will never be found, for we will be lost in the night itself, as if it were the ink black sea. Wait, I have to read you some more, because then it goes on into the you'll see. And so the young Heracles again, he is rather present in this book. "Oh, now, oh, then," said Mrs. Sweet out loud, but it didn't matter. It was as if she said it to herself, for no one could ever understand her agony, ever, ever understand her suffering, her pain. No words could express it. Nothing in existence could convey or express her existence just then, now or ever. Her husband's voice, her husband had been enfolded in an entity called Mr. Sweet. "I am dying," she said to herself, but that was silence. "I'm dying when I'm with you," said Mr. Sweet to Mrs. Sweet. "I'm dying, and that is why I hate you, for I am dying, and I can't be myself, my true self. I am dying, and you will die when I say this, but I am dying. I'm dying, I'm dying." "Oh, I see," said Mrs. Sweet out loud, but even she couldn't hear herself. And all that she saw then and now was silent. But she then could see the young Heracles sitting on a couch in the children's room, watching Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman defeat Karl Malone and John Stockton, and Michael Jordan, who then had a very bad cold, and each time he made a score, he almost fell down, but his fellow teammate Scottie Pippen was always there to hold him up, and the young Heracles, who worshipped Michael Jordan, held his opponents in high disregard and said they were lame. And Mrs. Sweet knitted and purled all the while, listening to her son whoop and shout and moan and cry out in agony at the very idea that his beloved Michael Jordan's team would lose. But then they won, and the young Heracles said to his mother, "Hey, Mom, I know you are going to say that this is just like Homer, that this is just like the Iliad, and there is Agamemnon, and there is Achilles coming up to save everything. Admit it, Mom, you're going to say it's just like in Homer, in that funny little voice of yours, as if you're on the radio, because you talk like someone on the radio. Your voice is official, but you're just my mom, and you're so ridiculous. I don't know what I'm going to do with you. You're so embarrassing." And Mrs. Sweet knitted away, For she was right then making the entire orchestra that would perform Mr. Sweet's nocturnes, but much to her surprise, when this jar was completed, the performers were all missing one of the arms they needed to play their instruments. So inevitable are the series of events seen over your shoulder as you glance back from the series of events that stand before you, and in your own mind you can see the series of events that are to come, that are arrayed before you, and they appear as if they are in the rearview mirror, but only in reverse, only as if the rearview mirror could make visible the thing that has not happened yet. For perhaps time, said Mrs. Sweet to herself, as she knitted away those garments with one sleeve missing, was a father, not a mother, and Mrs. Sweet had no father. That is, she had not been authored, she had been created by a very malicious woman. Oh, Mom, can't you see, said the young boy to his mother, and he was jumping up and down, running this way and that through the assembled crowds of shy myrmidons, Ninja Turtles, Power Rangers, Super Mario, Batman, various figurines from Star Wars, various stuffed animals, some resembling the domesticated, some resembling wild ones who are now extinct, and they all lay before him, and also they all lay before him in his memory, so fresh and so clean, Mrs. Jackson, that they still inhabited his now. And the boy, young Heracles, was now involved in the sadness of worrying about Ken Griffey, whose father had been a legend of baseball lore. Or so the young Heracles told his mother, and the young Heracles loved the young Griffey and was so involved in his faith, which might not be so full of glory as was his Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman. But just then, as he was sitting in his chair in the children's room, his father, Mr. Sweet, said to him, I must tell you something. And Mr. Sweet said, I don't love your mother anymore. I love another woman who comes from somewhere else, another woman with whom I have been taking ballroom dancing lessons. And we talk about Mozart, for she plays the pianoforte excellently, and she could be the next extraordinary piano genius of the century. The century is long, because centuries are long, though in your life you might, ha ha ha, find them not as long as I have found them. But I love her, and nothing can change that, and I don't love your mother. You know, we were always so incompatible, for she did emerge from a boat whose main cargo was bananas, and she is strange, and she should live in the attic of a house that burns down, though I don't want her to be in it when that happens, but if she was in it when the house burned down, I wouldn't be surprised. She is that kind of person. And on hearing all this, oh no, was a long howl of pain that came up out of the bowels through the darkness of the mouth of the young Heracles. And he furled and unfurled again and again like the petals of a flower as it comes into bloom and then fades rapidly. So did the young Heracles, who had only been sitting in his chair in the children's room, watching on television the young ball player Ken Griffey in the process of being or never being the great baseball player all the baseball world thought he would be. And Mrs. Sweet now broke in two, as if she were made of something to be found in the Pennsylvania formation, but she was not made from that, she only knew of that, and she wept and wept over the broken body of her son, who now lay on the couch, the television was on, but Ken Griffey was not on Mrs. Sweet's mind, Mr. Sweet never cared for baseball, except he liked Willie Mays, and could say things about Willie Mays, and that was all so great. Seeing greatness in a child's book. And Mrs. Sweet broke in two continuously, kept breaking over and over again, never into many pieces, just the same two, her heart, her head, and especially her heart, and shortly afterward the wiring in her heart became erratic and had to be ablated. But then, right then, Mr. Sweet elaborated to the young Heracles on all his disenchantment with the young boy's mother. She snores horribly. She smells of the past, for she's growing old. And so am I, said Mr. Sweet. But young women like me, and I do not like old women, said Mr. Sweet. Your mother is old. She has come to like Wittgenstein, but she does not understand him. She likes her Wartung, but she does not understand what she reads. She's very naive. She's very primitive. She's very amusing. She's wonderful when you're trying to be brave, but when you are with her and you face your limitations, she's a joke. She's an embarrassment. She's not my type. We're incompatible. But Dad, said the young Heracles, what am I going to do? And now he crumpled into the shape of a piece of paper on which the wrong thing had been written, and it had been thrown into the waste receptacle, never to be thought of again. And Mrs. Sweet gathered up her sweet son and wrapped him in a blanket she had made. In that one garment there was no error, and she wrapped him up in it and put him in the bottom of his bunk bed, a bed made of ash. Made of ash and purchased from Crate and Barrel. Wait. I'm allowed to read more. One last bit. Things change, Mr. Sweet was saying to Mrs. Sweet. Things change, but that was the harsh version, for he was in a state of rage. His voice was like a Wilkinson razor blade, newly emerged from that ironmonger's factory. His arms jabbed at her, but stopped short of making contact with the inconsolable mass of flesh, heaving with sorrow, and then resting from that. Things change, sweetie, things change. And he twitched his hips and shook his head vigorously, dancing to a music that was heard only by him. Or so Mrs. Sweet said to herself on seeing him then. And then he began to hum out loud parts of the Rite of Spring, the sea, the cat, the spider's web, the rat, the dog, the child's bed. And after he was done with that, he said to his wife, now shorn of her former dignity, Mrs. Sweet, and she was wearing a lovely brown dress made by Lilith. I never loved you, you know. I never loved you. Not because you were unlovable, though really you are. No one could love you, not even me, who knew nothing about love then. But now I do, and I see that I never loved you, for you are like walking into barbed wire in the dark. You are like an invitation to a tea party in an ant nest. You are like, I can't any longer right now think of what you are like. So said Mr. Sweet to Mrs. Sweet, and just then, right then, she was so beside herself with grief, and she wept, and her tears watered the primula capitata, which she had planted under the giant white pine tree, and so her tears were most welcome by that delicate plant, native as it is to the moist regions of the Himalayas. And she wept and wept, and Mr. Sweet spoke to her as she was bent over the parched primroses, themselves wilting and prostrate on the ground, suffering from the harsh conditions under which they were forcibly being cultivated, in the crotch of the roots of an evergreen native to Canada, though they came from the Himalayan region of the world. And Mrs. Sweet wept and wept and wept some more, for Mr. Sweet said then to her, you are just crying because you know the children and I will never forgive or forget the terrible things you have said and done, and that made her die a death in which she was still alive, not dead at all, but still alive and yet dead, for he showed her life as she had been living it, the moment when the beautiful Persephone had been put to bed at dusk, but she resisted it always, for she wanted to be with her parents. They did things that were mysterious to her, and she would delay that moment when she would be placed in her crib, for she had not yet outgrown it, and the thickly woven cotton blanket would be drawn up and carefully arranged under her chin, for her arms were folded up into her body like a bird, if you were baking it as a delicious dish to be served for dinner. Mrs. Sweet died and died, and in this way she lived for a long time, dying over and over again, never coming to a rest, a state of not then, not to come, not to have been, only now, only die and die and die. And Mrs. Sweet died, for she did die, and never again wore the denim jodhpurs that had been given to her by her friend Rebecca, who had seen them being worn by municipal workers in Japan when she was on a visit there. Each day has 24 hours. Each week has 7 of those days. Each year has 52 weeks. And it is so. And the age of the earth is made up of more than 4 billion years, of those years and weeks and days and hours, then, now, and then again, forcibly enclosed in it. And it was and is and will be so, Mrs. Sweet said to herself over and over again, as if it were a song that had been carried on the wind and she had heard it and taken it to heart, a song heard while walking along the banks of the Battenkill River for 28 miles, and she stood still then, seeing in her mind's eye the winding course the river would take, ending with it emptying itself into the Hudson River, some distance away from that place where the sea tides influence the river. All that is to come will change the way right now is seen. Right now is so certain. Right now is forever. What is to come will make, distort, and even erase right now. Right now will be replaced by another right now, and right now is all there is, and all there is over and over again, and no welling up of the fluids in the individual stomach, a universal metaphor for the unstableness of the whole human enterprise, as it is experienced by the person making breakfast for the litter of domesticated mammals before her or him, and the boy and girl with Game Boy or Super Mario in hand, as the case may be, no matter how it is heard, no matter how it is felt, and it is such a disappointment right now. For right now is always so incomplete, or so we feel, and that is a blessing, for it transforms then into what will come, all that will come, even though all that will come must contain right now and the unfathomable longing for the then, that time to come, after the earth was Precambrian, Hadean, Proterozoic, Paleozoic, Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Cretaceous, and lower this and lower that, and upper that too, and then Cenozoic, and rifting, and volcanic, that time to come after the earth was itself, that time to come when was the time that had been before, for beyond the earth's boundaries was all that had made it, was all that it had been and is, and the future was the past, and the past, which is then, it is always then, could be found in the periodic table. And Mrs. Sweet looked up and saw that pinned to the doors of the pantry was a map illustrating the principles of that thing itself, the periodic table. The beautiful Persephone showed an interest in chemistry, and her mother had purchased it and placed it there and then. Mrs. Sweet looked out the window through the panes of glass that separated and shielded her from all that lay outside the Shirley Jackson house, the house in which she lived with her children and her husband, and she could see a landscape so different from the one in which she was formed, that paradise of persistent sunshine and pleasant weather, a paradise so complete it immediately rendered itself as hell. Outside now there was spring in it, on the banks of the River Parron and stretching out onto the flanks of the Taconic and the Green Mountain ranges were large trees, some of them evergreen, some of them deciduous, and right then in bud. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
How do you do it? I read See Now Then in one shot and with very little coffee. And this is because it is a song carried on the wind. I mean, there's plot, but the plot is not what sustained me. I'm not saying that there isn't. But but it works as a complete undulating rhythm that in itself is the thing that seems to unite past and present, and in which past and present play with each other. I'm just at this point interested in the technique of how you sustain that kind of rhythmic energy over 180 pages. It's not something that it seems to me can be cobbled together.
If it can be cobbled together, I wish someone would show me, because it would have been easier. How does it sustain? I wouldn't be able to actually explain it. I always know how the thing I'm writing, what it should be. I always understand that. And the reason sometimes it will take me a long time to write is because it isn't going the way I understand it should be. I wrote, if you were to go back to my early writing, especially the first, the short stories that are not really by the standard of the short story, I don't know what you'd call them, but the first short story I wrote and which was published was one sentence long and 300 words, and I only knew that was what it should be. And I didn't. I remember giving it to my editor, and in a sort of disgruntled way, I just sort of thrust it at him and said, "Here, this is what my writing is," because I was writing at a place in which there was a very confined, established form of what a piece of writing was. There was And it was all superior writing. There was the idea of a short story, what a short story was. And the only person I knew who wrote a different kind of writing that I admired at this place I wrote was Donald Barthelme. Mm-hmm. Or the European writers, Peter Handke, would write things, and I thought, wow, this is writing. But the idea of the story as, you know, and then she opened the door and he came in and he said, "Well, what are you going to do?" His hands on his hips. I couldn't imagine writing that at all. That all seemed to me the least interesting thing about writing, that I wanted to write in this way in which I could feel out what really happened, what I could feel and I could think and I could use words. And people say, "Oh, the words are so simple," and the sentences, either I write simple words or my sentences are too long. I never can tell which is the worst. But I wanted writing to do to me what writing, I wanted to write the way the writing I had read when I was a child had moved me. That I was forced to read a lot of poetry when I was a child as punishments and or or things like that. And instead of it being a punishment, it turned out to have been a wonderful thing. But when I read the things I read when I was a child would make me feel that I wasn't myself at all, that I was something, and it wasn't ego, it wasn't that I was grand or anything. I felt like all a quiver, I just felt different. And I wondered how they do it. You know, it was as if I could, if only I could pick up the word off the page and it would just show me something else, not the page itself. I've always wanted to write like that. I've always wanted to see what it is the world meant, what it is it meant to walk outside, what it really meant.
And in your writing, where it comes off in a way that's so extraordinary is that you can hear that search and you can hear that movement so well, and it's sustained over the whole book. I want to talk about punishment in a minute, but before that, I just wanted to ask a question about Shirley Jackson.
Yes.
Wrote for The New Yorker, yes?
Yes, she did.
And rather famous short story.
The Lottery.
The Lottery. And rather upsetting to bourgeois and
yes.
local sensibilities about how people should act.
Yes.
So that just made me think of that, the fact that you...
That I named the
house,
yes.
the Shirley Jackson house.
Yes.
But let's go on to punishment.
The Lottery is about punishment.
Yes, yes, it certainly is, and there are stones thrown.
Yes,
quite a bit in your work, but let's really talk about punishment. You were this comes up in See Now Then. It also comes up in Annie John. It certainly comes up in Lucy, but in See Now Then, you actually recount the story of how, as a punishment, you had to copy out the first two books of Paradise Lost.
Yes.
And this would seem...
I was 7 years of age.
This would seem to be a kind of version of the, I'll say it, unfortunate Woody Allen joke that never take a course where you have to read Beowulf. but it seems to be some kind of example of English colonial education being imposed in a nasty way. And yet, to use a Dantean phrase, you did read further in the book.
I did.
Copied out those first two books and you read in them.
Yes.
What impact did Milton have on you?
Oh, I think, well, people will say that I'm harsh and I am... unforgiving, or I think some of the character flaws of that fallen angel, whose name means morning light, incidentally, but some of his character flaws I must have absorbed. I immediately, at seven, identified with him completely.
Well, he certainly has a problem with his paternity.
He does, as do I.
Yes.
Yes.
His parents, his father.
And authority.
And authority. He has a very big problem with authority. And he's cast into hell, which is a certain kind of natural world, not unlike the natural world that's coming up. The great geological natural world
surges
at the end of the book.
Yes, yes. But he does say this wonderful thing, which even at seven I understood completely: better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven.
Yes,
I did understand that.
Yes,
in my limited understanding, you see, the hell and heaven. Was England was heaven, and where I was from, where we were all from, the colonies were hell because they were not England. And I had always thought it would be better to be king of my hell, my little island hell, than to be a servant in England. I understood that immediately. It's very interesting, moral sophistication of a child. I think people don't really believe in it. People who study it often, they go back and forth. They don't believe in it, or they say, yes, children have moral judgment and can do all sorts of sophisticated things. I don't think I was an unusual child, but early on I understood all sorts of things. And one of the things I understood that was that there was it was a good thing to love to love not Satan but Lucifer.
That's right, because you refer when you refer to him, you do tend to refer to him as Lucifer.
Yes.
And Lucy's epiphany of self-discovery is that her name
is she's named after Lucifer.
Lucifer.
Yes. Yes, he's a much maligned character. That's all I can say.
Although there were a number of poets and writers who seemed to think that both who admired him and thought that Milton admired him.
Yes, I would say yes.
But also in Paradise Lost, once we get past copying out those first two books, there's a great deal of the poem that takes place in a garden.
Yes.
And in your book on gardens, you begin, it's framed by, you're mentioning reading a Prescott's great book, The Conquest of Mexico and Peru.
Yes.
And then the final chapter is about Eden.
Yes.
Which you feel any garden book any discussion of gardens is necessarily going to reference.
Oh, it's so uncanny to me that almost every making of a garden or the relationships that take place in a garden, you can almost find that they are in the original story. Gardeners, for instance, are incredibly envious of each other and competitive and misbehave badly. You can always find that some relationship of betrayal in a garden or theft. I mean, there are certain gardens you can't go into. You're searched before you're allowed in them because people are always taking things. But gardeners are notorious for their quarrels and their competitiveness.
Which can be aided when someone such as Satan or Lucifer
comes along.
Comes
and there
along
usually
and,
is.
And, yes.
There usually is someone
and so
who comes along. A judge will say, well, I mean, there are these famous quarrels of whose rose is better. What other hobby do you find people saying, well, you know, a great subplot in that stupid Downton Abbey is will the Duchess's roses be judged better than the lowly person? You know, that's just such a...
It's an English thing.
Yes. Yeah. You know, you can go to the Philadelphia Horticultural Garden Show. It's always like that. But for me, the going back to Milton and the garden, it was in reading Milton, reading that, and which I do all the time, and then going back to the garden, and I had this revelation about the arrangement of the garden, the story of the Edenic invention that I think plays out in just all of civilization, is that in the making of the garden, that first of all, the garden comes very near, I think it's the last thing really created. And I posit that as a garden is something that comes at the end of civilization, of the making of society, that you do a lot of things and then you make a garden, but that's one thing. But the specific way the Garden of Eden is made has always interested me, that the tree of life comes before the tree of knowledge. It's arranged that way in the narrative. And it occurred to me that, of course, the tree of life is agriculture and the tree of knowledge is horticulture. And that is what happens in garden societies or in civilizations that have gardens, that they have enough to eat. They're always civilizations that are prosperous. So once you've grown enough food, you then begin to make a garden that's only for something to look at. It's only to be enjoyed aesthetically. It has no purpose but an inner one. Whereas the tree of life is, you've got to It gives you life. And I saw that in some way in Milton, that the, or it was reading Milton that made me go back and look at the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. of that story. That story, which is only, I don't know, six verses or so, it's very short, it's just everything.
It's quite remarkable.
It's remarkable, yeah. It's remarkable. Anyway, but, you know, I mean, you talk about Milton and you ask me about Milton and there were three books really that probably are the great influences apart from my mother's voice on my writing. It was and they all have to do with my mother. I had a Bible. We all had Bibles. We had to have Bibles, and I had a little King James version of the Bible, which I read over and over again because I had nothing else to read. But when I was seven, the two things that happened when I was seven was I had to copy books one and two as a punishment. I can't remember what I did wrong, but I remember the punishment. And then for my seventh birthday, my mother gave me a copy of the Concise English Dictionary. It was the smallest of the concise. It was the concise of the concise.
Very concise.
Very concise. Very concise. And I read it from A to Z, and then I read it again. And it's a great influence on my writing in that it is why I repeat words and try to find a way that the same word can be used in a different way and cast a different light on the whole sentence. It's a very big influence on my writing, the dictionary.
And the King James Bible is also works by parallelism and repetition.
That's absolutely right. And it begins sentences with conjunctions.
Many conjunctions.
Many conjunctions. Which I do all the time.
When you're in your book, My Brother, you write about one English writer's discovery of his delight in gardens, particularly in cottage gardens.
Yes.
And then you then talk about your brother's banana planting.
Yes.
And then there's a relation there between that and his dying.
Yes.
How can we see the relation between his dying as a kind of planting or replanting or rebirth in relation to a garden?
My mother was this extraordinary gardener, but she was beyond a gardener. She was the sort of person who could eat a fruit, you know, and like the taste of it, thought it had some special quality, and would take the seed. I have two examples of it, a breadfruit and a soursop. She liked the taste of it, and so she took the seeds and planted them. The breadfruit tree grew up into the most extraordinary breadfruit tree everyone had ever seen. It would be admired, and breadfruit trees are a dime a dozen where I come from, but that particular one was just extraordinary. A soursop she ate somewhere, and she came back and planted the seed because it was just wonderful. And it grew into a beautiful soursop tree and was alive, vigorous for a long time. Then she'd gone back to Dominica and eaten a passion fruit. And she loved the passion fruit, so she brought it back and planted it, and it grew up the soursop tree so vigorously that it then caused the soursop tree to sicken and grew vulnerable to ants. The ants then began to invade her house, and this made her so angry that she burnt the tree. All this happened actually while my brother was dying, and he at the same time of the burning tree and the insects and so on. And incidentally, the thing about red ants and my brother is that they almost killed him when he was a baby. So I hadn't actually even understood the whole cycle of that. But in any case, while this was burning the tree, and I remember going home and just seeing part of the yard quite close to the house on fire, but my mother knew it would never burn the house. It would just limit itself to the tree. He then had developed, he was the gardener. I was never really the anything. Of my mother's gifts, I think he inherited, or the other children seem to have inherited them more than I did. Anyway, he was this great gardener and could do plant things and grow things in the way that she could. And it struck me that as he was dying, that his life was the opposite of flowering.
I see.
And so that's how... but, you know, these are just probably just the way my mind works in metaphors. And I think I'm always making some connection. I'm very bad at sums and mathematics and so on. But I'm very much less bad at seeing that there are things have a magneticism to them. Mm-hmm. I'm much better at noticing that. But that was the for me. It was sobering to see as he was dying this proliferation of vegetable matter.
Is the garden ultimately something that must fail? That chaos is introduced into it? I mean, can there be such a thing as a wild garden?
Well, people make them, and wouldn't you know, the first people to make them were the English. there is a style of gardening called the English garden, and it's more, strangely, the ordered garden is Italian. And then the French borrowed it, but then as the British entered into an association with other parts of the world, and they brought in all sorts of other plants, and they made this, there's a thing called the English garden, and it's supposed to be wild, which is things growing into each other. And from that comes the cottage garden. And the cottage garden is pieces of little bits and pieces of flowers that the cottager, who's the poor person, steals from the person he works for and makes a garden out of it. And then naturally the rising middle class sees it and makes an aesthetic out of it. But it's the cottage garden is just a garden of poor people. It's sort of like collards and kale, things like, that's now good for you.
Perhaps, maybe just end with from Mrs. Sweet's story of creation, the story of the nature of any story, the story being the definition of chaos, of the unstable, of the uncertain. Is that in a way what story writing is, in addition to creating order, is in some way also creating some chaos?
Oh, I think so, because I think so. I'm always interested in the person who can do, who's involved in art, making the perfect thing. I'm always interested in people who are interested in perfection, because the minute you turn your back on it, it's it just gets rickety. It changes. It's not stable. It's not that I am interested in chaos. I think that's mostly what it is. Or the minute it's orderly, it's on its way to being disorderly, that it's in constant flux. And it always seems to me the thing I want to understand is how to live with it, how to survive with it, not make peace, but just how to go on with it with the this chaotic, this imbalance, this. I mean, I think every day you get out of bed, it begins anew. You go to sleep, and then that's something. That's one state. But then you get out of bed, and the whole thing is all rickety, and you know, and you get through it, and you hope you haven't transgressed too much.
Not too much.
Not too much.
Please join me in thanking Jamaica Kincaid.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.